welcome to Zet Forward, a podcast celebrating authors and other individuals who are involved with projects for the benefits of Seton Hall University and the world around us. My name is Jerry Shea, and I'm proud to welcome and introduce our guest for today, Dr. Christopher Tankin. Dr. Tankin is Associate Professor of Education, Leadership, Management, and Policy at Seton Hall University in the College of Education and Human Services. He is a former editor of the American Association of School Administrators, Journal of Scholarship and Practice, and the current editor of the Kappa Delta Pi Record. His research interests include school reform issues, such as standardization, the influence of curriculum quality on student outcomes, and the construct validity of high-stakes standardized tests as decision-making tools. And we'll talk about some of that today. He has authored over 85 publications. His book is titled The School Reform Landscape Reloaded, More Fraud, Myths, and Lies. His new book with Kara Mullen is The Risky Business of Education Policy. And thank you so much, Dr. Tankin, for joining us today. I appreciate it. And I will just say that I love the book. It really put things in a really great perspective for me as it relates to, you know, sort of charter schools and school reform. The idea that charter schools really don't increase student achievement if you control for, you know, like socioeconomic background. That was an eye opener for me. And just like standardized tests, basically they just show that you make if you make money and the test results reflect your academic background, not your intelligence or anything like that. So that was a really great context for me. So I really appreciate the book and thanks so much for writing it. It was really fantastic.
Thanks, Jerry. It's a pleasure to be here today.
All right, great. Thanks for coming on. And first question, what inspired you to write the school reform, the book, The Landscape Reloaded?
So quite frankly, I just got tired of hearing how broken schools were. Mm-hmm. You know, in the mainstream media and social media, we were being bombarded for decades, actually, with misinformation about schools. And then when you really dig in to the underlying data on public school effectiveness, the data were telling a very different story. So I decided to write about that story and present the actual data. And that's really how most of my books get started. I find misinformation about a topic related to my area of expertise, you know, curriculum assessment, and then begin to investigate it. And, you know, along the way, while I'm doing that, you know, I provide direction for educators on how to improve things while remaining true to the evidence. So I really try to bridge the gap between the research and the practical application for school leaders and teachers. But I'm trying to, you know, tell the truth, so to speak, so we can really, you know, continue to move forward with public education instead of being mired in misinformation.
Right. And there's a lot of misinformation about that out there. So then interesting that the sort of the context for the modern reform movement was Sputnik. And that came out of some information, too. So misinformation, I think. So if you could, a lot of people probably don't know about it. I didn't know about it. So people might not know about it. Like, how does Sputnik really spurred this reform movement back in the 50s?
Yeah, sure. So one thing that I've noticed and you'll notice when you read the literature, or you just listen to the arguments being made. There's always this argument being made that in some way U.S. students are falling behind their international peers. And you hear these terms thrown around, you know, this is a Sputnik moment. You know, this is our chance to get ahead, so on and so forth. And so that really interested me. And so I began to wonder, you know, were we really behind in the space race? Because I couldn't understand, if we were behind in the space race, how we ended up on the moon. And the Russians never ended up there, right? So, you know, lo and behold, started researching, and I found my way into the Eisenhower Library. And in the Eisenhower Library are all the declassified memos. And so I just started going through all the declassified memos from the meetings that were held about Sputnik. And in one of these memos, you know, Eisenhower comes out and says that he knows we're not behind. The scientists gave a briefing that we could have launched a satellite years before the Soviets. But Eisenhower explained I'm paraphrasing his words, he did not want to open up space and start World War III in space. So right. He thought it politically, he thought it was better, okay, let the Russians open it up And so then we will, you know, we'll follow behind that. But what, so he knew, and the scientists knew that we had the ability to launch a rocket years before Sputnik 1. We didn't do it on purpose. And he knew that the public schools weren't a problem. But keep in mind, Jerry, the context back then was it was really almost forbidden for the federal government to get involved in local education. And the Eisenhower administration and his advisors were trying to find ways to pump money into public education. Okay, they were looking to pump more money in education, but they knew it was taboo at the time. And so they really took advantage of this, and they said it was actually good fortune that this happened, because now this allows us to put forth a bill, which became known as the National Defense Education Act, which allowed them to pump NDEA, National Defense Education Act, and that allowed them to pump millions of dollars into education to increase basic research, both at the high school level and college level. Okay, tons of money went into higher ed for research.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. And that's how they did it. They used Sputnik as an excuse to pump the federal money into public education.
That I didn't know. Very interesting. So is that the National Defense Education Act? Is that still in effect? Is that like No Child Left Behind? Is that a reauthorized?
No Child Left Behind was born from the Elementary Secondary Education Act of 1965 during Lyndon Johnson. That was a different act. So those two were not connected to that one was not connected to Sputnik.
Okay, very good. Okay, interesting. Yeah,
ESEA, which is the parent of No Child Left Behind, was part of the War on Poverty.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, that's another good. I didn't know that context.
Yeah,
that's
part of the Civil Rights Package. Oh yeah, yeah. That's what that was put in for.
And every 5 years they're supposed to reauthorize. Is that
5 or 7 years? We went quite a long time between Bush and Obama. NCLB went way beyond the 7 year reinstatement, 5 year reinstatement. But we just got a new one back in 2018, ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act. It's the same. It was essentially the same thing as NCLB. However, it allows states to create these programs where corporations can be paid if they come up with programs that improve achievement. So it's opened the door to corporate investment, but it's not investment. It's greater corporatization of public education.
Oh, wow.
They're called performance bonds. And it's guaranteed money for programs that, quote unquote, improve achievement.
So this is just another avenue of the privatization thing that's been going on for a while now. And I think you mentioned the book, which is interesting. No Child Left Behind was basically a Trojan horse, kind of, right, for some of these efforts into privatization. And if you could just talk a little bit about that, that'd be great.
Sure. Yeah. Well, one of the things that No Child Left Behind brought in was this. At first, it was a mandate that you had to set aside a certain portion of your Title I federal funding money for private companies to conduct tutoring services.
Okay, interesting.
Cool, right?
Yeah.
And so what schools had to do is actually go out and hire private companies to provide after school tutoring services and use their Title I money to pay for it. After widespread abuses of that system and pushback from the schools, it was finally allowed that schools could use that money to have their own teachers, the actual people who know the kids, provide tutoring services as well. So a lot of schools went in that direction.
Interesting. Yeah, I did that. That's another history that I didn't know about. So they had to use private tutors. Amazing.
It was a blatant attempt to bring in the private market into schools.
That's amazing. Okay, now just in terms of, I know you talk about John Dewey a lot in the book, mm-hmm. his book. So what was the like? So what guided your research in terms of like the philosophy?
Yeah, sure. So I'm guided by progressive education philosophy, and there's there's basically four pillars to that, right? So we the philosophy focuses on the number one, the way that students learn the best. So let's make sure we use methodology, pedagogy, that fits the way that students learn best. And generally, that's when we treat students as active constructors of meaning who bring prior experience to the classroom. And we involve them in the learning process. The second pillar is making sure that the curriculum is connected to the student. So, you know, wrapping the curriculum in interesting topics that are relevant now for whatever age level you're looking at. So you're making that connection between the new knowledge and the student's experiences. Okay. The third pillar is understanding human development, that, you know, students develop cognitively, socially, emotionally in different stages. So we need to be really cognizant of the types of curriculum standards, the types of activities that we do with kids, and make sure they're pliable. Make sure they address a wide range of developmental stages instead of expecting everybody to know the same thing in the same format on the same day. So that's not developmentally appropriate. That's developmentally inappropriate. And then finally, the fourth pillar is making sure that the curriculum and instruction is attuned to social forces of the day. Because if progressive philosophy is based on the idea of preparing students for the way the world will be. So since we don't know how the world's going to be, right, we need to expose students to a lot of different ideas, a lot of different skills, and the education always needs to be relevant, right? And so those are basically the four principles of progressive education, and that's really it's known as a curriculum paradigm put together by Daniel Tanner and Laurel Tanner many years ago. But it's really the lens that I use to look at education through and make sense of things in the education landscape. And so that's what I use as my primary framework to do my research.
Right, and you talk about the Common Core standards in the book and how, like, for CISPA, and I think you mentioned, especially for students who are, you know, in poverty or, you know, sort of lower socioeconomic level, a lot of the stuff is not relevant. You talk about relevancy. It's not really relevant, right, to them. So it also becomes like a kind of a punitive thing, learning things that are not going to help you in any way. It's got to be a kind of a horrible, you know.
Yeah, well, think about this. It's really... I find it almost it's backwards now, where you have almost 50% of the school population, okay, is non-white, right?
Yes. Okay.
We are still dealing with a curriculum in all 50 states, because all 50 states were influenced heavily by the Common Core. We're dealing with a set of curriculum standards in all 50 states that is really made by the dominant white class, relevant, okay, only relevant really to the dominant white middle class, all right? And so we're really leaving out the future of the country. You're leaving out 50% of the future of the country through this curriculum that is clearly based on dominant white middle class culture.
Absolutely.
So it's violating this idea of connecting content to kids.
Yes.
In the progressive philosophy, it's violating social forces. It's actually socially static. It's not socially responsive in any way. And so that's why, you know, a lot of what I also write about is, you know, how do you make an irrelevant curriculum relevant? And you know, we do that at the classroom level with the teacher, in terms of the activities that he or she designs. So you can, you know, just because you have this irrelevant curriculum doesn't mean you have to deliver it that way. So, you know, part of what I write about is repackaging kind of like a socially unconscious curriculum, okay?
Right.
Around topics that are more relevant to kids today. And so we can still teach the mandated standards, but we repackage it in a way that that respects the students that we're working with.
Right, right. That's a great point. And in the book, you talk about consumer, like they frame this charter school as consumer choice, right? But there's really not that much choice, and it really is very much top down, right?
Yeah, the whole exactly. The whole idea of school choice comes from an economic theory of consumerism.
Right.
It has no basis in education, and it's really not a choice at all, because when you go to these a lot of these charter schools, well, the charter schools don't have elected boards of education.
Wow, it's true. Of course, yeah.
Okay. And more or less with most of these charter schools, it's their way or the highway. it's really interesting to look at the attrition rates in charter schools, and you know how many kids they take in third grade, and how many of those kids are left by fifth grade. How many kids did they take in at sixth grade? How many are left by eighth grade?
Right.
Because the attrition rates in many of these places are abominable. They're offensive, offensively high attrition rates. So it's definitely a shell game, and it's really not choice at all.
Right.
It's false choice. You don't really have a choice once you get in there.
Right. You're stuck, and you're going to do whatever right. They're teaching, you're learning.
And,
yeah.
And getting in itself, it's not equal choice.
Right. So talk a little bit. How do they shift the students?
So technically they'll say they run a lottery system.
Right.
But there's study after study. Another big one just came out. It was fantastic. A group of researchers, they sent emails and made phone calls to hundreds of charter schools, and they used different names, different last names. So they used white sounding names. Right. They used Hispanic sounding names. They used African American sounding names. And they also described their children in different ways. Some children they described as having disabilities. Some children they described as having language issues. Some children they described as, you know, being high achieving.
Right.
Jerry,
right.
Guess which ones got called back or responded to the most?
The white kids, I would just guess, the ones who are high achieving.
The white kids that didn't have learning disabilities.
Right.
And the students with the inquiries with African-American sounding last names and Hispanic sounding last names, disabilities, ELL, got responded to the least. So we know what's going on here. It's very clear in their practices. So, yeah, they use a lottery, so to speak. But even when you make it through the lottery, what some schools do, and I know this because I talk to, you know, some charter leaders are actually willing to talk to me on background. You know, I can't use their names or where they're from.
Yeah,
but in the research, you know, in the research, I try to seek out people who will talk to me. And so one of the things that they use is they use intake interviews.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
So once you are, you know, once you win the lottery, you go to the school for an interview. And that's where they get to, you know, look at you and see what you're all about. They do some they may do some diagnostic testing and so on and so forth. And then if you look like you're going to be a high scorer on tests, because that's how they, you know, they market themselves on achievement.
Course.
If you look like you're going to be a high scorer on tests, then they make it sound like it's the greatest place on earth. If you don't look like you're going to be a high scorer, then they start to tell you things like, well, you know, here, this we require this. I don't know if you're really going to be able to do this. And also, by the way, we require, you know, 20 hours a month of on service by the parent. Well, look, some of these parents are working multiple jobs, non-standard hours, just to support their child. They're just looking for a good education. So then when you can't come up with the 20 hours of volunteer work and this and that, you know, you're not accepted to the school. So they do all of these things to cherry pick the students that they want. You know, and I'm not saying all charter schools do that. But what has happened over the past, especially the past decade, 15 years, charter schools have become corporatized. And now they're run by really, they call themselves nonprofits, but they're run by these charter chains. It's almost like a Walmart of, you know, Walmart of charter schools.
Wow.
You know? Like and so there'll be these companies that run hundreds of charter schools, and they're also usually financed or invested in by some of the big Wall Street banks.
Gotcha.
Also, hedge funds are heavily invested in here because they make a lot of money off of them. What they do is they loan them money for facilities.
Okay.
Okay. Remember, the loans are backstopped, guaranteed by the taxpayer. So even if the charter school goes under, the taxpayer has to pay the money for the loan on the building.
Oh, my goodness.
So the big Wall Street banks and hedge funds are making a lot of money on facilities loans right now. That was part, and that was all made possible by a set of tax credits put in under the Clinton administration. It was, okay. They weren't meant for charter schools. They were meant to revitalize our urban areas so that if you were to go and invest in an urban area,
right,
in real estate and whatnot in an urban area, you got some tax breaks. So the big banks get the tax break on that end, and they get the guaranteed interest on the facility loan on the back end. So they're getting it both ways, okay? Whether the charter school succeeds or not, it can be in business 1 year. You know, if it's a 5-year, 10-year lease on your building, the taxpayer is paying that for 10 years. So it's become a business. And so that's what really – I get really concerned when we start to treat students as part of a profit margin rather than treating them as developing human beings.
Exactly.
So that's why I chose to call it out. You know, I call it out in some of my research.
Well, that's great. It's important to do that. And so basically, yeah, the way the charter schools have evolved here, they've kind of perpetuated. I mean, they were originally meant to kind of give people opportunities. And I think you said at the beginning, that was definitely what they were doing. But that has evolved over time.
The first charter schools opened in Minnesota and California in 1991. There was two of them. They were really what I call mom and pop. They were specifically made for students who were being underserved.
Right.
Okay. They were family run, and many of the charter schools were like that. They were community run.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
You know, they were started by teachers. They were started by people who were trying to do something different, and so they really did start out with a noble cause. You know, and I applaud those schools that are still going. They're doing great work, but it's the industry. It's become an industry. It's been overrun by corporatization. I want to give a shout out to a couple of colleagues who do some just outstanding work on the segregation aspect of charters. So Julia Rubin from the Blaustein School over at Rutgers, and her colleague Mark Weber, they've done some outstanding work on the segregation aspect of charter schools. You know, 90% in most charter schools, 90% of the student body is all the same. There's no diversity in these schools. Okay. And so they've done a lot of work. And then Bruce Baker from Rutgers has done a lot of work on the finances of charter schools and also the attrition rates that I was talking about.
That's fascinating.
Really taking some deep dives into the data, and it really pulls it apart. So those are three people that I really rely on when I'm doing my research on charter schools. I rely a lot on their work and interactions with them.
All right, that's great. Thanks for it. And I'll try to put those in the show notes, I guess, if later on when we're done, when we post the podcast. So could you just talk about that, Chris, a little bit? How the students they cherry pick students, but as they're at the school, the lower achieving students sometimes end up being pushed out for testing.
Okay, so what happens is, you know, the charter schools take the kids that they think are going to score the best on these standardized tests. Because again, many of them run around and market themselves on high test scores. So then when after the student takes the first test, let's say it's third grade or fifth grade or sixth grade, whatever's in the school, whatever grade levels are in the school, if they don't do well, they're generally kind of counseled out of the school.
Counseled out.
They're persuaded to exit the school, or they're exited from the school. So one of the things that Bruce Baker is great at, this looking at the student enrollments of these charter schools over time and looking at cohorts. So let's say a cohort comes in 2020 in third grade, how many students in that cohort are left by the end of fifth grade?
Right.
And so he'll show that cohorts decrease 20%, 25%, 30%.
Right.
And what's funny then you overlay their test scores on top of that. So you have a graph of enrollment that's going down, okay, from third, fourth, and fifth grade.
Gotcha.
And then you put the graph of achievement, and the graph is going up third, fourth, and fifth grade.
Right.
Well, that's because the kids who weren't scoring well are no longer in the school. So that's what's making the achievement go up. You're going from 100 kids to 72.
Gotcha.
Okay. Your test scores are going from 58% to 75% because we've gotten rid of students who are not scoring well. That's what they do. Those are the games that are being played. And,
right.
You know, and at real public schools,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
we don't do that.
Right.
We take everyone who comes to the door, we take them. And we do the best that we can with students, regardless of their disabilities, their challenges, their English language status, their poverty status, whatever it is, public schools take them. Charter schools, many of them, not all, many of them try to exclude them.
That's really interesting. So they're kind of they're sort of fudging the numbers on in a certain way, which is very interesting. And you also in the book talk like about standardized tests in general. So if you could just talk about like standardized tests once again, the best thing they're really best at kind of economic income or is what they're best at sort of judging and how that relates to test scores, not actually like achievement in a sense.
Yeah, sure. So look, there's 100 years, I guess it's over 100 years now. Starting with World War I, over 100 years of research
mm-hmm.
that shows standardized test scores. A large portion of the test score is based on out-of-school factors.
Specifically
out-of-school factors related to money, okay? So time and time again on every test, whether it be a state test, the SAT is also well known for this.
Right.
You know, the SAT, every $20,000 of your family income goes up, your SAT score goes up. Okay. Without end, every $20,000. In aggregate, that doesn't mean that, you know, every single student is going to score within their family income band, but in aggregate, okay, the test
gotcha.
Scores increase as family income increases. And that's like that for all standardized tests. And there's a couple different reasons for this. Number one, you know, family income, what it is, it's a gateway to experience. Okay. And so students with higher family incomes are out and about more. Okay.
Right.
And the experiences that they have are more academically related. There's a lot
yes.
of what's known as collateral learning going on.
Right.
Okay. So you really see this in kindergarten. It's the greatest place to see this because you have some kindergarten students who come, they have a huge sight vocabulary. They know
yes.
a lot of words. Some students even come to kindergarten already reading.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where do you get sight vocabulary from? You get it from being out and about in the world.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So the larger your world, the larger your sight vocabulary,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
generally speaking. And so because standardized tests are also very text based, okay, even the math tests are really reading
yes.
tests with numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because they're so text based, it really benefits students with larger vocabularies and higher higher reading levels. All right. The other
mm-hmm.
thing, the other thing is a lot of research on the types of questions that are asked on these tests and the types of situations and examples that are used in reading tests and literature tests. You know, it's very common again to see examples that use very white middle class language.
Right.
Okay, still attached to the white middle class canon of literature,
right.
with those kinds of experiences.
Yeah.
So they're really made. They're not made for at least half the kids in the country. So the language is dominant class. The examples are dominant class. I mean, there's been examples on standardized tests. Well, but maybe you might even remember this, Jerry. I don't. Might have been 10 years ago, okay? 10 years ago in New York City, all of a sudden, all the New York City schools were taking field trips to the farm.
Oh, no, I don't remember. That's great,
and
though.
And that's because on the third grade test in New York City, right, there was reading passages and examples having to do with a farm situation.
Interesting.
Okay? And some of the city kids had never been to a farm, so they don't have the context. Doesn't mean they don't know the material.
They don't have the context.
But you don't understand, you can't make that connection to the context. So it's harder to understand and decipher what the question is being asked or what the passage is saying when you don't have prior knowledge. I mean, think about reading something that you have no prior knowledge of.
Absolutely.
You can't make a connection to it. There's nothing to help you make sense of it.
Yes.
So that's what we're actually doing to students with standardized tests. In many cases, they are non-contextualized.
Yes.
Again, that violates this the progressive principle of connecting content to students. So these tests are very static, and they really pick up more on this idea of family and community social capital. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you're out and about and you've had a vast amount of different experiences, right, you're going to be able to make connections to more things, even if you don't know about them. Oh, yeah, okay, I've seen that. I recognize that. I may not know a lot about it, but at least I understand the context. Whereas if you're coming into something and you have no context, you can't even make sense of it. And it's interesting because you'll see students who score some of our students who come from poverty or different cultures who might score low on a standardized test, when you give them a curriculum-based test based on something that they actually learned in school,
right,
they do much better. And that's because the teacher contextualizes the information in the classroom. The teacher will use examples that the students can relate to. So they're teaching the content through relational examples in context, and the students do much better because it kind of, the teacher is the mediator between that lack of social and community capital, and the student. The teacher fills that gap by providing the appropriate examples, by actually creating the prior experience on the spot for the student.
Yeah, that's a great example. So basically, these standardized tests are just totally out of context for these students.
Out of context. They use language that really favors white middle class students. They use examples. I mean, there's been examples on standardized tests about, I told you, the farm.
Okay. Yep.
So there's certain kids who don't have those experiences. There's been examples about yachting regattas. There's been examples about Wall Street.
Right.
And even some of the, you ready? Even some of the vocabulary. So plumbing versus pipes, supper versus dinner.
I mean,
things that we take for granted,
right? Yeah.
Because we're from the dominant culture.
Right. Right.
That's not some of those. It's different language.
Yes, no doubt. Yeah, totally
it
different.
It doesn't mean the students aren't learning or they don't know the material. They do. We're just not. We're not assessing it correctly.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That is really interesting. And that one thing which stuck out in the book to me was, I think you had a quote from someone who said the only problem with the American education system is poverty, essentially. Like, if you got rid of poverty, there wouldn't be any issues.
Yeah, so we've done a lot of studies at Seton Hall. We've been able to, and colleagues have done them before me, as well in other states. We just picked up the mantle here at Seton Hall and continued the work. But we've been able to predict the actual percentage of students who are going to score proficient or above at the district or school level.
Okay? Right.
For state tests in New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Iowa, and Ohio so far. Okay. Our predictions in many cases are in the seven, we can predict 75% of the schools that are going to pass this. We can predict 78% of the districts that are going to pass this thing using only family and community capital variables from the U.S. Census.
Right. Right. And what does that include? What are some of the
Of that would be household income. Okay.
Right.
The percentage of bachelor's degrees in your community.
Gotcha.
The percentages of single family households in your community, and specifically single family run by a female.
Gotcha. Okay. Interesting. Right?
Percentages of households with income over $200,000.
Gotcha.
Okay, so that's households. And then percentages of families, not households, but families. So these are the ones with kids. Right.
Right.
Families with income less than $35,000.
Okay. Right. So then that's a good, really good predictor of how they're going to score, how people will score on the standardized test. Which
right.
Is
and again, I have to – it's not because students with those factors can't learn.
Right.
They can. It's that this, the test that we're giving them is not measuring their learning.
Right, exactly. Really, yeah, right, really good stuff.
The results are contaminated by out-of-school factors.
That's really interesting. Another thing in the book, I think someone said that if they just corrected for the housing, if they created – how someone had like a good place, like a safe place to live with, you know, because lead in the pipes, a lot of places, the poverty issue. But like if the housing issues were corrected, that would also have a huge effect on you know, on student outcomes or even standardized test outcomes.
Yeah, a countywide study down in Montgomery County, Maryland, showed when they used more integrated housing, students did much better in school.
Okay? Interesting.
Again, because think about it, right? Now we're you know, we're taking students who were segregated in certain types of communities. Their worlds were very small. Okay, we're giving them a chance to be in other types of communities where the world is much larger. They have more life experiences. They have access to libraries. They have access to playgrounds. They have access to peers with different backgrounds. Okay, so everybody benefits from that.
That's amazing. So important. Yeah. So like, yeah, the context, who they live with, who their peers are, the cultural capital they are exposed to, it's just really important. I think that's
and it goes both ways.
Yeah. Right?
It goes both ways because American society is very diverse, and it's important that we all have experiences and access and opportunities with that diversity.
It benefits everyone.
Everybody. It's a learning experience and a growth experience for everyone.
Absolutely so important. Absolutely so important. I think you talk about that in the book too, which is great. You know, like, you know, rich people can benefit from, you know, experience, you know, living with poor people, and, you know, this sort of this economic, you know, melting pot, and not, you know, sort of in a way is really important, which I think that's a great point and really important for people to understand. You know, rich people, you know, it's not good for them to be separated. You know, it's much better that they be just in with everybody else. So I think
there's a large body of research that shows wealthy people segregate themselves.
Yeah.
And then what happens is, in some cases, not all, okay, not of course, I don't want to overgeneralize, but the research is clear that they become their reality is much different than the reality of society.
Gotcha. And
they become detached. They can become detached from the reality of society.
Right.
And that's not good for them. It's not good for a democracy.
No, it's not at all. No, it's terrible for democracy, right? Yeah, it leads to all sorts of bad things, you know, which we're probably seeing some of this policy really as it relates to schools,
yeah,
right?
You see, well, you mean it ends up in factionalism, tribalism.
Yes. Right. Okay. Absolutely. And we're seeing that, unfortunately. But yeah, so I think this book is you know, sort of a step towards sort of healing some of that stuff.
Hopefully. And that's why the public school, think about this, the public school is the only public institution, right?
Yes.
The only public institution where we have the opportunity for all future voting citizens to pass through.
Yes, okay, that's true. Absolutely.
Where they can become socialized to the principles of democracy.
Yeah.
Right? In a way where they're interacting with students who are different from them.
Right, right.
Right. You know, that's the great promise of public education that, of course, we're still trying to fulfill even more than 60, 70 years after Brown versus Board of Education.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But it is the potential of public ed. And so, you know, when you introduce these choice systems that allow for voluntary segregation, you're just going in the wrong direction.
I agree 100%. All right, Chris. Well, thanks so much. We'll wrap up with a few questions, a few wrap-up questions. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So what's the next project you're looking at?
Well, I mean, I'm on a project now that we're starting to wrap up. It's an international project with some universities in Italy and in the UK. I'm doing the U.S. side of it. We're studying schools in Italy, the U.K., and the United States that use outdoor education curriculum.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, and we're looking we're looking for characteristics that kind of cut across continents and cut across cultures in terms of successful and effective outdoor education programs. Again, right in line with progressivist philosophy of hands-on, experiential.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's right. So I'm involved in that right now. That'll be the next publication that I do. You know, the latest book, The Risky Business of Education Policy, which just came out. That, as you said, that was an edited volume with Carol Mullen.
Yep.
We got some great chapters in there on the corporatization of education, segregation of charter schools, the current state of Brown versus Board of Ed, a great piece by my colleague at the University of Oslo in Norway on the PISA testing. Another great piece on democratic education. So that book was a great project for me to put together. Searching for these researchers on these important topics. So that just ended, and I'll probably at some point in the not too distant future do a second edition of Defined Standardization: Creating Curriculum for an Uncertain Future. That came out about in 2016.
Okay, all right.
And I'm looking for different ways to update that now.
All right, sounds good. So maybe we'll have you back on the podcast when that comes out.
Would enjoy that. Thank you.
All right. And so where can people find the School Reform Landscape Reloaded and also the Risky Business of Education Policy?
Yeah, look, all of those are at your large book distributors. I mean, I prefer if you go through private bookstores.
Good point. Absolutely.
Independent. I really enjoy independent bookstores, but you can get them anywhere. There's information on my website. That's www.christinken.com. And also I'm on Twitter at Chris Tinken. So there's many different ways to find me and interact. I mean, I love interacting and collaborating with people.
Sounds good. Sounds good. I'll put those links also in the show notes when we
great.
All right. So thank you, Chris. I appreciate the time. This is a great discussion. I have to say I learned a lot from the book, and I learned a lot from you in this discussion. And I think it's really important a topic. It has a lot of it's social justice. It's, you know, it covers so much, and it's so important to our society. So yeah, thank you for writing the book, and thank you so much for coming on. And thanks to everyone for listening, Zeph Ford, and please join us next time when we talk to another person from the CNOL community about their work and how it benefits the world around us. Until we meet again, all the best, and Hazard Zeph Ford.